Hey, we are continuing through our series this summer on the Mount. This morning, I came across an interesting quote. I spent a lot of time studying the Beatitudes this week, and that's what we're going to cover today. But I wanted to share this quote from Tony Campolo. Now, some of you are saying, well, that name, well, that doesn't mean anything to us. He was actually a former spiritual advisor to some presidents, and this is what he said about the Beatitudes. He said, if we were to set out to establish a religion in polar opposition to the Beatitudes Jesus taught, it would look strikingly similar to the pop Christianity that has taken over the airwaves in North America. I want you to take just a moment and let that sink in. And I know that's probably challenging for some of you to hear. But I'll be honest with you, I think it's a statement that is very true. If we were to set out to establish a religion that's in direct opposition to the Beatitudes, what you have is popular Christianity in America today. So we're going to be covering Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 through 12. It's this section that Jesus gives blessings. And it was really a radical thing that Jesus did when he stood on that mountain. He proclaimed, made these statements. Radical today. And when we really are radical then, and when we really look at them and what they say, they're just as radical to those that hear them today. As we walk through this, I hope and pray that we see just how challenging these words are to the status quo. It really challenges normative things in culture. The term Beatitudes comes from the Latin word for blessed, which is beatus. The Greek word that's used in the original text, manuscripts, is makarios. This is a word that has been translated as both blessed and happy. Now, I know we have some new faces with us today, so don't be intimidated by the Greek and the Hebrew. There's going to be a lot of that today, but I'll try to explain it the best I can. If you're a regular, you know how important it is for me to talk about these things because sometimes it changes how we interpret the text. But this is one of those words, blessed. Happy. Happy are those. Blessed are those. It's one of those words that I feel like has lost its significance in our society. Blessed. Kind of like the word awesome, right? We use awesome so much. You ask somebody, how was your pizza last night? And they would respond, it was awesome. You know, that was kind of one of those words at one point in time that was really reserved for something that was truly spectacular, like God. But today, blessed falls into that category. I'm sure you've asked somebody, you know, how are you doing today? And if they're a hyper-religious person, I love the charismatic people because they do this a lot. How are you today? I'm blessed and highly favored. You know, how many of you heard that? Blessed and highly favored. I don't know about you, but when I encounter those people, and I've got some friends that are like that, every time I say, how are you doing? Blessed and highly favored. And I really want to ask, what'd you put in your coffee this morning? Because I'd like to have some of it too. You know, I hear Abby singing in the shower. She would kill me. You know, hey, but it's her fault. She said, Dad, I know you have a lot more notes than usual, so I'm going to help Mama in the nursery. I'm not going to sit up there today. So I'm gonna pull a punch on her. I hear her in the shower. And one of the songs that pops on her playlist, I'm so blessed, got this heartbeat in my chest, you know. And I wonder if she realizes what that really means, you know, to be blessed. I don't want you to miss the significance of what Jesus is doing here, this action, how it impacted the people that originally heard this. You know, we have the temptation in our life to associate blessing with material things. You know, man, I got a new car this week. Man, God really blessed me. Or, hey, I got a good promotion at work. I'm blessed. God blessed me. I'm sure you've made some of those statements yourself, or you've opened up your social media and you've seen a picture, you know, it like paints a perfect picture of this great family and it's got the hashtag blessed. And if you're honest, you're probably scratching your head thinking, man, how come I'm not so blessed? You know, why does my life not always look like that? Here's a quote from Vanitha Rendell Risner. She's a contributing author to Desiring God, a blog that John Piper puts out, and she says this: one translation of the New Testament, the English Standard Version, has 112 references with the words bless, blessing, or blessed. None of those connects blessing to material prosperity.
Think about that. In the New Testament, in the English Standard Version, there's 112 references to the word bless, blessing, or blessed, and none of those connects to material prosperity. She goes on to say, what is blessing then? Scripture shows that blessing is anything God gives that makes us fully satisfied in Him, anything that draws us closer to Jesus, anything that helps us relinquish the temporal and hold on more tightly to the eternal. So I want you to write this down if you're a note taker. And this is kind of the foundation of where we're going to go with the rest of the time this morning. The bestowing of a blessing is connected to both being satisfied in God and being favored by God. So I will say that one more time. The bestowing of a blessing is connected to both being satisfied in God and being favored by God. And I think it's interesting that in the creation account, in Genesis chapter 1, we see God blessing His creation. We see God blessing humanity. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 27 says, and God blessed them and told them, be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. Isn't that interesting? So right there in creation, God bestows a blessing on humanity. And here, last week we talked about one of the things that's significant about Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. It's a new kingdom, a new king, a new people, a new creation, so to speak. And Jesus, at that moment, pronounces blessings in another way that Matthew's tying Jesus to God. And this is important for us to keep in mind as we continue to unpack this. So I want to ask you to turn to Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 through 12. If you have your Bible, if you don't have your Bible, but you have your smartphone, I did do an event on the YouVersion Bible app that has the entirety of that text there. And I did try to get it all on the screen today. You know, Jeff Dorrell told me after service last week, he said, hey, I liked your new program, but you got to try to stay on top of it. And I said, yeah, I know that's hard for me to do. So I'm going to try to do better today. I want to read to you the entirety of the text, and then we'll come back and kind of break it up into bite-sized pieces. So this is what Matthew records Jesus' words as in Matthew chapter 5, starting at verse 3. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now, I've seen a lot of resources and listened to a lot of sermons that have taken the approach to break these Beatitudes up individually, and you'll have one sermon on verse number 3. One sermon on verse number 4. And I want to hit each one of these individually, but what I want us to do today is I want to consider them as a whole. Because I really think what Jesus is doing here is he's painting a picture. We could use the analogy of the Beatitudes as being like a stained glass window. You know, we have a lot of beautiful stained glass in this church. And the reality is, when you see the window as a whole, it's a beautiful thing. But if we were to take each one of those pieces individually and look at them individually, they wouldn't be as beautiful. They'd be kind of bland. And so I think what Jesus is doing is he's giving these blessings one at a time with the intent of taking them as a whole. And when we get these as a whole, we get a picture of something very specific. What he seems to be doing is describing a disposition of a person. And I would call this section of the text, of this his sermon, it's the disposition of the devoted. So we can't see the true beauty of what Jesus is saying if we just take one out of context. We need to look at all of them together. So we're going to start with verse number 3. And this is what Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." I want to think about just a moment the original audience, the people that were there listening to this. We talked about this briefly last week. The audience would have been comprised of both Jewish people and Gentiles, and most likely predominantly Jewish. But if you go back to chapter 4, verses 23 to the beginning of chapter 5, you see a pretty good breakdown of the audience that was there. Matthew said, "Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and people brought to him all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, those having seizures, and the paralyzed, and he healed them. And large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan followed him. Now when Jesus saw these crowds, he went up to the mountainside and sat down." And so what we see is we see a bunch of sick people that are following Jesus around. The poor, the infirmed, the suffering, the destitute. And these are the people that were really looked down upon in that society. If you watch the Chosen series, they do a great job depicting what these people, how these people lived in that time period. Specifically the episode with the woman of the issue of blood. You see just how shunned and how valueless these people were in the eyes of society. And these are the people that are sitting there. This is what Matthew says. They were sick, demon-possessed, they were having seizures, everything was going on. They were deformed, they were considered unclean, which means they couldn't go to the temple, they couldn't participate in their religious rituals. Now the religious leaders, I believe, had pity on these people, or had no pity on these people, because their rituals prohibited them from having any contact with them. And so what you saw was a distancing of these type of people and the religious people, the Pharisees, the scribes, the teachers of the law. They would separate themselves from these type of people, and there was a barrier that these people couldn't seem to break to get to a relationship with God. And Jesus is addressing these kinds of people. And for them to hear these words, the people that have no value in society, it's a message of hope. Now, what we can't do is we can't be tempted to equate this idea of being poor in spirit solely to material possessions. And this is one of the things that's been done over history. Over the course of history, people have looked at this and equated it strictly to material possessions. It's recorded that the Emperor Julian, the apostate, once said that he wanted to confiscate all the Christians' property so that they might all become poor and enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, poor in spirit may include poverty, material poverty. It probably did. But it cannot exclude a lack of value in the eyes of society, because that's really the focus. Poor in spirit is more about lacking a position within the community. Now I think about the suffering servant in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 3. And I think it's a perfect description of what this looks like. Now, for those of you that are familiar with the Old Testament text, you'll know that we say that this is a prophetic text and it's talking about Jesus. Isaiah 53, 3 says, "He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem." Now, this is the kind of people that Jesus is speaking to in the Sermon on the Mount, and this is the kind of person that Jesus became. Now, let's think about the audience today, because the audience today is a little bit different than that audience. Specifically, I'm talking about us. You know, I've been guilty of saying to my kids, you know, we're poor, but in reality, we're not. You know, compared to the rest of the world, we are extremely rich. We find ourselves in a much different position. We're not poor. We're not destitute. Now, don't get me wrong. We go through difficult times. We go through difficult circumstances. But as a whole, our lives are not deplete of value. Many of us have a voice in some of our community circles. People listen to us. We're not outcasts. And so we're much different than the majority of individuals that Jesus addressed in this sermon. those people that Jesus addressed had nothing to lose. They had nothing to lose. They had already lost everything. On the other side of the coin, for many of us today, we have everything to lose. Hearing these words, responding to these words cost us something. We have a lot to lose. We have esteem. We have standing in society. We have material possessions. And so there's two ways that we can respond to Jesus' words in these Beatitudes. For a person that has nothing to lose, and maybe there are some of you here this morning that feel like you have nothing to lose. If you're that kind of person, if you really are down and out, dejected, these words bring hope. But for those of us like myself that have everything to lose, these words really bring challenge. And I think that's fascinating to me that Jesus addresses this crowd, and for the two different types of people that hear it, they're hopeful to one group and challenging to another. And so here he starts with, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And really what this boils down to is a person that is spiritually bankrupt. A person that recognizes, whether you might be materially rich or not, a person that recognizes, "I have nothing to offer God," is a person that is poor in spirit. And Jesus goes on to say in verse 4, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." And there's an aspect of this word that's akin to grieving and lamenting. You know, we did a series, I don't know how long ago it was, but a whole series on Lamentations, learning to lament. It's the strongest word in the Greek language used to describe sorrow over losing someone or something that you hold close. And so I think it's fascinating that Jesus says, "Blessed are those who mourn," but he doesn't qualify the type of mourning. He doesn't say, "Blessed are those who mourn because you've lost someone you love. Blessed are those who mourn because you've lost your livelihood." He doesn't say anything like that. It's a generalized statement. He just says, "Blessed are those who mourn." And it's when we build off of the first beatitude that we realize the depth of the mourning that Jesus is describing. You know, the first beatitude describes the brokenness of the world and life. We are poor in spirit. We have no value. We have nothing to offer God. We might have good standing in this life, but when it comes to standing before God, we should be poor in spirit. And the system of this world creates a system of oppression, brokenness, and marginalization. That's been the constant throughout history. Any system that we try to construct in this world, it just creates brokenness, oppression, and marginalization. And Jesus says, "Blessed are those who mourn," because he's expecting that we would be people that would mourn over the condition of this world. We should be people that are mourning over the condition of his creation and the condition of our own hearts. Then he moves from mourning to meekness in verse number 5. "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth." Now, this word is used to describe both Moses and Jesus. Now, you remember last week I said one of the things that Matthew does is Matthew paints Jesus three ways. He says Jesus is a new king like David. He's a new Moses, and he's God with us. And so right here, we see Jesus himself saying, "Blessed are the meek." And in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3, in the Septuagint, which is the you'll see LXX if you do some study, it's the Greek Old Testament. The same word that Matthew uses here for meek, the Greek Old Testament uses to describe Moses. Some of your translations in this beatitude may have the word gentle, or you might have a footnote that says gentle. Blessed are the gentle. It's one of those words that sometimes we associate with humble, though they're really not the same thing. So I want to look at meekness versus humbleness. Jesus, interestingly, is described both as meek and humble. But here's the difference. Meekness is really strength under control. We see this when we look at Moses. Moses, if you read through the account of the Exodus and everything that he did, we'll know that he was not a weak person. So don't misunderstand meekness for weakness. It's not the same thing. Moses was meek. He was a strong person. But he developed this capacity to have that type of strength, but to control it. So when we think about this specifically, meekness really relates to the way that we treat other people. Humbleness is our attitude or our view towards others. You see the distinction? Humbleness is really like an inner attitude. Meekness is an outward expression of that. In Matthew chapter 11, Jesus calls himself both. Chapter 11, verse 29 says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am," your translation may say gentle, but it's the same word that he used in this beatitude. "I am meek and humble in heart." Now, let's pause right there for just a minute, because we're only three deep into this here. And already we've seen how these all kind of correlate to who Jesus is. Tuck that away in your mind. Right? Each one of these statements is tied directly to who he is. All right, let's go to the next one. I'm not sure I like this Prezi too much yet, but I'm trying to give you all, like, you know, maybe some of your heads will be spinning by the time we leave here, the way these slides move. But the next one in verse 6. "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled." Hunger and thirst for righteousness. We're not going to talk about righteousness a whole lot, but we'll talk about it a little bit later. But I want to focus on that idea of hungering and thirsting for righteousness. This is the word hunger is where we get, how many of you ever heard the expression, like, to pine over something? When Barbara was pregnant with Abby, she literally pined for Mexican food. I mean, I think we ate at Mexican three or four times a week. And by the end of that pregnancy, I swore I would never eat Mexican food again. But, you know, I didn't hold to that. I still eat it. But you've heard that expression, to pine for something. It's like intense hunger, a craving. It's the Greek word paneo, which pine, where we get that. Intense craving for righteousness. And then he's not just one word. It's not just people who hunger, but people who hunger and thirst, eagerly longing for something to drink. Now notice, this is what's important about this specific beatitude. Notice what Jesus says. He says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." And it's a future tense, "for they will be filled." Now, what he's saying is, you're not righteous yet. Because if you're hungering and thirsting, you don't have it. Right? I'm not pining for Mexican food if I have a taco sitting in front of me. But he says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." You may not be righteous, but if you have that eager desire, that intense craving, that longing for righteousness, the promise is you'll be filled. And just what is righteousness, we'll get to that in just a moment. But blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. There's something that's driving you for more, is what Jesus is saying. And then he goes on to say this, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. And I want to do a deep dive into this one particularly. This isn't just about pitying someone or having pity on a person. It's not just about feeling sorry for somebody. That's not mercy. Having pity for a person, it has nothing to do with what Jesus is talking about here. The idea is that a merciful person is one who is actively compassionate, actively working on behalf of somebody's desperate situation. It's a really interesting word. The word is, I don't know why I should have another slide there. I must have put it on the wrong one. Yeah, I did. So I'll move forward, but here's, you kind of get a snapshot of the original languages. I want to do this for a specific reason. This word merciful, in the Greek New Testament,
is used in the Greek Old Testament, not just to describe mercy, but it's used in place of the Hebrew Old Testament word chesed. Okay, chesed is all about God's covenant faithfulness. It's about his compassion. A lot of translations, English translations, will translate this as God's loving kindness. And so when we take both of these ideas into account, what we see is Jesus is saying, blessed are those who are merciful. It really puts us in an interesting position. It puts us in a position where we recognize that a person is in a desperate state, and we get close enough to that person to almost feel their brokenness ourselves and be moved by that brokenness to work on their behalf. Here's why I want to keep talking about this. One commentator, William Barclay, said this about chesed and mercy. It's the ability to get right inside the other person's skin until we can see things with his eyes, think things with his mind, and feel things with his feelings. And here's why I think this is so important. We said this is a word, chesed, that's used to describe God, and what a perfect picture we get of God's mercy in Jesus. When we think about Barclay's definition of chesed and mercy, the ability to get right inside of a person's skin, feel what he feels, think what he thinks, this is what Jesus is. This is what Jesus does. He takes on human flesh. He gets right in our skin, and he feels what we feel. When we read the New Testament, we find he was tempted in every way like we are. He felt pain. He felt agony. He mourned. He wept. He was able to think how we think. And he showed mercy for us. Now think about that for a moment. Here's another one that's tied directly to Jesus. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. And we get a picture of Jesus doing that exact same thing. He comes in human flesh. He feels what we feel. And he shows us mercy. Let's go back to the next one. Matthew chapter 5, verse 8. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Purity was an important thing in the Jewish religious system. There were plenty of purity laws. Read through Leviticus and you'll get tired of reading about all the laws, but you'll find just how important purity was, cleanliness. Now Jesus puts a descriptor on this. He says, blessed are the pure, blessed are the clean in heart. See, this idea of purity is understood from three different perspectives. Cleanliness or purity, it was understood from the physical sense, like hygiene. Was a person clean? Did they take a bath that morning? There was also the Levitical sense, which is the law. Were they able to keep all those commandments? Were they able to avoid dead bodies? Were they able to not eat unclean animals? Were they able to wash their hands before they ate? Right? Because that was a big deal. Look, it's a big deal today. It was a big deal to Jewish people then. You did not want to eat before washing your hands. That was Levitical impurity. You did not want to walk through a field on a Saturday and be hungry and pick some of the grain and eat it. Why? Well, that was against the Levitical law, and that made you unclean. And then there's clean or pure from the ethical sense. Just being able to do what's right, avoid what's wrong. And I think what Jesus is doing here is he's hitting directly at the Levitical idea of purity and cleanliness, the religious sense. See, because what happened in that day is the religious leaders had put a huge emphasis on outward cleanliness and purity. Keeping the law outwardly was of the utmost importance. Their focus was on the outside, and later what you'll find in Matthew's gospel and the other gospel writers is that Jesus confronts this. He's always challenging those religious leaders. Like, the outside might look clean, but the inside is filthy.
And so right here in the Beatitudes, Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart. It's an inward purity. And so Jesus knew that the inside had to be clean before the outside could ever become clean. Now think about our culture today. And let's think about the quote from the beginning. You know, for some time now, I have been so completely convicted and challenged that if Jesus were to come and walk amongst us like he did in this New Testament period, he would have the same words for people in the church that he had for the Pharisees. We've become so fixated on people doing the right things, avoiding the wrong things, looking the part, that we've neglected the heart. We've neglected the interchange that has to take place. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. And the next one is really challenging. Skip this. We put it in the wrong spot. Matthew chapter 5, verse 9 says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. If you don't hear anything else this morning, I want you to hear this. Being peaceful and being a peacemaker is not the same thing. It's not the same thing. Peacemaking is much more difficult and costly than simply being peaceful. And notice what the blessing is. I'm gonna do this in the care. Blessed and highly favored are the peacemakers. You're favored by God if you're a peacemaker. Now again, we see a picture of being a peacemaker in Jesus. Jesus is the ultimate peacemaker. Now think about the birth narratives and the way Jesus is described. In the Old Testament, the promise is he's going to be called a Prince of Peace. In the New Testament, we get the announcement, peace on earth, goodwill toward men. And Jesus is the ultimate peacemaker because he makes peace between God and humanity. You see, between that blessing in Genesis 1 and where we're at today, there's this thing called the fall. And what the fall does, what sin does, is it puts enmity between God and man. Strife. The inability to have a good working relationship. And Jesus comes and he relinquishes that. He says, look, I'm going to step in the middle here. I'm going to make peace between mankind and God. The ultimate peacemaker. But it just doesn't stop there. He makes peace between humanity and God. He gives us the capacity to come back to God in a right relationship. But he also gives us the capacity to have peace with each other. You know, that's what this sermon's all about. This Sermon on the Mount is all about hearing Jesus' words and becoming people that can be like him and make peace between two parties that are at war with one another. I think this is one of the most challenging Beatitudes. And this is one that really makes me think about that quote, about how the American church today seems to be concerned very little with peacemaking. Some of you are going to be mad at me after this. But the American church cares very little about making peace. We've become more politically motivated. And as we've become politically motivated, it divides us. It doesn't make peace, it divides us. Listen, peacemaking avoids picking sides. And it works to bring both sides of any perspective together. Peacemaking avoids picking sides. Jesus came and he walked in the middle and he said, look, I'm going to bring these two parties together. I'm going to bring these two, even amongst ethnicities. He brought the Jewish people and the Gentiles together. And in the church, we need to be able to take a step back and stop picking sides and make peace between the two different sides in whatever battle we're facing. Now, this one is challenging, but it naturally leads right into the next issue that Jesus addresses in verses 10 through 12, when Jesus says this, because if we are true peacemakers, we can't avoid this. Jesus says, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. True peacemakers experience persecution. True peacemakers experience ridicule. He goes on to say this, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you." Now pay attention to this. "Because of me." I told you we were going to talk about righteousness later. Here it is. What's this idea of righteousness? Now notice what Jesus does. And it completely changes the way I see these Beatitudes. Jesus equates righteousness to himself. In verse 10, he says, "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness." And then he gets more intimate. And he turns and he looks at his close disciples, the ones that were following him closely. I think he turns and he looks at them and he says specifically, "Blessed are you." And we could see Jesus doing the same thing to us. "Blessed are you when people persecute you because of me." And so what Jesus does is he describes righteousness. He gives us the definition. What is righteousness? It's him. It is him. Now think about that when we reflect back on verse 6. "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." Everything that we've talked about today in these Beatitudes is seen and realized in Jesus Christ. So if we had little pieces of stained glass, one piece for each verse, and we were to put those pieces together, at the end of this, what we get when we put that final piece in is we get a picture of Christ. "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for him." Now here's what I want you to understand this morning. This is not a checklist. You know, I've read commentaries, I've heard sermons that say, these are the expectations of people who are Christian. Listen, what happened in the Old Testament was people boiled the law down to a checklist. The law became a checklist of don'ts. Don't do this. Don't do that. And people failed to see that the list of don'ts was given to help shape their hearts. Now, if we're not careful, we'll do the same thing with the Beatitudes. Now, Beatitudes are different because it's not a list of don'ts. If we take it strictly for a list, it's a list of do's. Read those. "Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are those who mourn." So do these things is what Jesus is saying. But if we strictly look at it as a list of do's, then we miss the heart portion. Because it's completely possible for us to make that, okay, I just got to do this, I got to do that, and our heart can still be in the wrong spot. Listen, there's 8 or 9 of these Beatitudes, depending on how you count them. And it's describing their characteristics of a disposition. And I want you to know this. I've become keenly aware of this in my own life. If I'm honest, that's not the kind of person I am. That is not the kind of person I am. If I'm not careful, I'm not merciful at all. I'll give you an example and tell myself. We had a baseball game this last week. You know, one of the rules in baseball is after the third inning, as a coach, if the other team's pitcher throws 3 balls, the coach comes in and pitches, right? And I got so frustrated because the other team's catcher wasn't really giving me a target. You know, so I was having trouble throwing the ball. And my initial reaction was, I'm going to go in that dugout and I'm going to tell my catcher when their coach comes out, don't give him a target, make it hard. I mean, that shows you right there what kind of person I really am. All the while I've been studying these Beatitudes. I told you, for somebody that has everything to lose, it's a challenge. But listen, doing these things does not make us a Christian person. This is not our natural inclination. Jesus is painting a picture. He's showing us of himself. And this is not a picture of who we are. This is a picture of who we are becoming. Don't miss that.
This is who we are becoming. And the more we become like him, the more persecuted we'll be. And it comes from all angles. Jesus wasn't just persecuted by the irreligious, but he was persecuted by the religious as well. And I just want to encourage you that in our culture, in this, even this American Christianity thing that's going on, if we really become like Jesus, we're even going to be criticized by religious people. And the beauty of Jesus' blessings is that they're words of hope for people that are downcast and words of challenge for people that are elevated like me. And so when we read these words, when we let them saturate into our very being, my prayer is that God would continue to form us into a people that embody this kind of disposition more and more. You know, maybe you're like me. Maybe you found yourself challenged by this. Wow, you know, I'm not the most poor in spirit, not the most merciful, not the most meek person. And maybe you're questioning, you know, do I really have a good relationship with Christ? Listen, the goal is that we would be more like him tomorrow than we were yesterday. That we would be more like him 5 years from now than we are today. You know, I tell myself a lot, I like to be transparent. Yeah, I'm not perfect. I mess up. I say things, I do things that don't look like this picture that Jesus painted. But if I'm honest, I'm more like Jesus today than I was 5 years ago. So let's not boil this down to a list of you got to do these things. Let's boil this down to Jesus is painting a picture of who we are becoming and allow the words to shape our lives. Let's pray. Father, I pray that as we continue to process everything that we've heard, that your spirit would continue to work in us at the heart level, that you would continue to give us a new disposition, that we would recognize, Father, that we really have nothing to offer you, but we are truly spiritually bankrupt. And if it were not for Jesus taking on human flesh, feeling what we feel, thinking the way that we think, and dying the way that we die, that we would have no hope. We thank you for making peace with us. And I pray that as we continue this quest for you, as we hunger and thirst for your son, Jesus, that you would make us more and more like him. And when the world sees that, they wouldn't see us, but they would see him in us, and it would draw more people into your kingdom. And I pray these things in your son, Jesus' name. Amen.